involved in the decision making, that would pass the information if they were interested or something else. But that they thought was without question assessing them.
Then he asked about
the son. I was able to remind him of these rules and regulations
that I was able to talk to him about the subject.
I did suggest he might be able to talk to his son.
But I mean, they really were like that. Sullivan was like that. Tobler was 10 by the time that it came out. Sullivan had clearly been like that. But there was also this frustration of the council. I think until the mid-70s, it wasn't a functioning movement. It really had something to do other than come to a meeting and learn the place. At least during the first 4 years I was there. It probably wasn't its very early days, but in the first 4 years I was there, I didn't see that. I mean, it was a dog and pony show, is what was happening. I mean, they had no real committees to do any business or whatever else. But they then became a fairly political group. We used them effectively politically.
They then became
an effective political group. In other words, the chairman of the council would send a letter to the political establishment, saying how concerned they were about these issues. Now, it wasn't now coming from Stony Brook, it was coming from the citizens of the community. And it changed the nature of the dynamic tremendously.
We were, over a period of time, able to generate a good deal of support with Newsday, a good deal of support with the Long Island political structure, and in fact, to deliver.
Was more news at Newsday than?
Bill had left. Bill had left. I literally would go to Albany almost every week, maybe once every other week, and would walk the corridors. And there was a particular person, and it's irony of ironies in some ways. There was an assumption that Johnny was beginning to emerge as a very powerful political figure in Phillips. And then as he was leaving, if you recall, he was seen as a major force on the island in a whole variety of ways. Johnny, frankly, wasn't very good with legislators. It's a problem for him now. He's too literal. I mean, he's back to the rational. Legislators are used to dealing with the irrational.
He was liked by the business community.
Business community liked him, but the political structure, he didn't understand it. He didn't understand the pressures on politicians. And always thought, geez, if you just rationally explain your case, people will look at the rational data and make a rational judgment. I wish that were the case. But in any event, there was this assumption that Johnny was very tight with Joe Margiotta, for instance, who was the Nassau County Republican leader and maybe the most powerful political boss in the state. I think Johnny met him maybe once or twice in 10 years, but everybody thought they were good buddies. And we had this, one of those meetings with Margiotta was at, we had gotten to Margiotta because we were talking about a law school. And John Scaduto, who was then Nassau County Treasurer, I think may still be Nassau County Treasurer, arranged for this meeting. So we went in to see Margiotta's office. I somehow expected, in my naive way, a mafia type to come out, and it was this extremely handsome, articulate, warm fellow who invited us into his office. I, at the time, was a good liberal Democrat. Here I was in the banner of the arch-conservative, the enemy, and was absolutely charmed by it. But one could tell that after about a 20-minute period, he was getting bored. I mean, it was like going to see the Pope, you know. You have your time period, especially with your business time. And it was clear he wasn't interested in talking about the law school. He wanted to talk about getting more kids into medical school. And that was his agenda. And he finally leaned across the desk. And this was right about the time the film The Godfather was out. And he said, "What is it you want from me? What can I do for you?" I mean, it was that look. The problem with Johnny, and this is why I said he was not necessarily good as a politician in that sense, was that politicians like a clean, neat slate. Tell me what you want, number one. Tell me what you want, number two. You ask Johnny that question, you got a smorgasbord answer. I want it all. And I could see that all of a sudden, I mean, Johnny started listing off about 20 different things, and I brashly just interrupted him. And I said, we're interested in the social and behavioral sciences building. We're taking a lot of kids from Nassau Community College, and we're not able to provide the education for them, and we're having to turn them away, and whatever else it was. He stopped the conversation. Morgiana says, I'll see what I can do. That was his comment. We walked out of the room, and I said to Johnny, you realize we just got the social and behavioral science building. It was a major project we've been fighting SUNY on forever, and SUNY was saying they couldn't do it for a variety of reasons. But we've never been able to generate the real political threshold. And Johnny said to me, do you really think that's how it works? And here he was in the 8th or 9th or 10th year of his presidency and still hadn't seen that whole thing. And we did get the building that year, and Margiotta did not fight us on the law school.
He did not fight us on the law school,
and he was very closely tied to Hofstra and whatever else. Yeah. But I use that as an example of how we started to play a political structure. And a key element of it was using Johnny the right way. I mean, he really, in some ways, he couldn't be involved day-to-day with legislators. It was not his forte. He and Leon Giafrida, I mean, they would be daggers with each other. They were just totally different types. So I cut my teeth on all this and was sort of the intermediary with a lot of these folks. There was a very well-placed person who, in the annals of Stony Brook, will not be well-known. But was absolutely instrumental in a lot of things that went on there, and I would guess no more than a handful of people know about him. And his name is Sandy Frucher, Meyer Frucher.
How do you spell it?
F-R-U-C-H-E-R.
Meyer
Frucher. Sandy Meyer. Meyer Sandy Frucher. At age 28, he ran Moynihan's Senate campaign. He was a Joe Crangle protege out of Buffalo. He happened to be good friends with Harry Weiner, who was succeeded Bob Nathan's at the school which became the Harriman School. And I think he had been a student of Harry's at Harvard and JFK School. But Sandy was extremely well-placed politically. Sandy is not a nice man. Wasn't then, isn't now. Sandy's job, as I understood it, only years later in the legislature, between campaigns, he had some commission responsibility in Albany. But he made sure that the legislators' nocturnal activities were well supplied. He is today the head of the Battery Park Authority. He is known as a close former political advisor. You will see him at NUP occasionally. Battery Park is one of the largest construction projects in the history of the Northeast. All of this begins to make some sense. But because of Harry Weiner, I went up to meet him. Mentioned where I should go and meet Frucher, and I went up to meet Frucher, and Frucher was sufficiently well-placed that he ran some commission, I don't remember the name of that commission, would issue 3 reports a year, and whatever. He was a big-time political operative.
Is he in the Red Book?
Probably not. these aren't in civic texts, is the problem here. He may be because he's head of the Battery Park Authority now. I have his phone number. I talk to him every once in a while. His daughter was interested in admissions at Cornell this year, so he called me out of the blue, and we had a lengthy conversation. But Frucher was someone who would get things done. And I, for instance, went up there, and we were talking about the problem, and he says, well, I'll get Steingart to do this. He says, give me a letter. So I wrote a letter from Stanley Steingart to Beth Moore and Ernie Boyer that essentially said that my colleagues on Long Island are deeply disturbed by the priorities of the SUNY system with all of the resources apparently going up toward Buffalo, and they have great needs down there, and we expect the trustees and the central administration to take care of those needs because they are, one didn't need to read too far between the lines. These were fairly tough letters. Frucher would walk in and get Steingart to sign them, and Steingart didn't know what the hell he was signing. He'd sign it, the letter would go up, then he would run next door to the chairman of Ways and Means, who was Arthur Kremer, who was from Long Island, and said, look what Steingart just signed. Will you send the letter? Oh, yeah, sure. The speaker did. The next thing you know, there was this phalanx. Now, the Democrats were saying Stony Brook is important to them. It was all a myth. I mean, the political structure was never behind it, but what was happening was, and that's how politics works sometimes, is you create these impressions of, and SUNY was then having to respond. this was during the time that Ernie was leaving. And if you think about it, Ernie came down to Stony Brook. His last...
I think...
Okay, here. Continue. Okay, I don't remember where I was. You're talking about crucial of the political myth.
Ernie Boyer.
Ernie Boyer's last act as chancellor before going down to Washington, because he flew to Washington for the press conference announcing his appointment as commissioner of education, was to come down to the campus at a sure Stony Brook at a public press conference that SUNY was committed to completion of the master plan for the campus. That outraged the SUNY people, who again were responding to the other political kinds of things. Here was Ernie. It didn't cost him anything. There had been a lot of pressure in Newsday. Bob Green, the Newsday multiple Pulitzer Prize winner, had identified Stony Brook as a potential rallying force and place around which Long Island could establish its own sense of identity. So Newsday had taken a very active role in promoting Canada. And Green, who was then a very, very powerful figure on the paper there, Long Island editor, had been the one there. He liked Johnny a lot. Ernie leaves. Johnny denied it, but I think he would have liked to have been chancellor. He never said it to me at all. When I probed a little bit, I never got anything resembling positive response. But I think it was once he didn't, it was clear to him he was going to go elsewhere in his own career. Now an opportunity came. That was really an absolutely pivotal point for the institution. Because the campus still was in chaos. One could go on for hours about the nature of governance there or the absence of it, so on and so forth. Johnny's leaving was the point at which either the institution was going to continue toward that goal of a comprehensive program, and part of the problem was that I don't think it was widely understood at all at the campus where SUNY really was coming from and why. I mean, the political thing. So there was in a sense, the campus was protected from that information. We didn't have a governance system that worked, or the town meeting form of governance to the extent you had it. So that kind of information wasn't really shared nor widely understood. And the pivotal issue, and I think I understand this much more clearly in retrospect than I did at the time, although I thought with a degree of clarity at the time, was the decision to replace Bob. Because if there wasn't somebody who was going to fight on that issue, it was down the tubes. I mean, the game would be over. That gets into the Alec business, to say. I'm enormously fond of Alec. I have a series of biases as a consequence of the personal relationship, but trying to step back from those. He was, in many ways, more pivotal than Johnny, in my sense, in getting the campus where it was going. And in fact, the pivotal character. He was the one who had to deal with SUNY. He was the only one who understood really how they worked. He was the one SUNY wanted out desperately because his planning models, because there was so little understanding of a research university in Albany, he was much better at developing planning models and what I would call political arguments for academic issues and academic growth and development than anybody in SUNY was. So we would make our case to SUNY. It was very hard for them to shoot it down on a rational basis, because they didn't have anybody competent enough to do that. I mean, going back to the point you made earlier, there was nobody there who understood what a research institution was. SUNY always felt caught between Stony Brook's ability to develop all these arguments, which they had such difficulty shooting down, and that frequently defined the issues, and this political process,
that they were having to respond to for other sections of the state. And, you know, Warren Anderson succeeds Bridges and Warren Anderson from Binghamton.
Yeah.
You know.
You had that issue.
You also had that Alec was the campus SOB.
In what sense? Faculty or students?
He was always the guy who delivered the bad news, not Johnny. It was Alec. When people were arrested, it was Alec who was out front. When you had the real fights with the faculty on different kinds of issues, it was Alec who was out front. He always headed the commission which studied the issue. I mean, it was Johnny's solution to a large number of problems. Now, I will say, I think Johnny was aware of a lot of Alec's weaknesses. Not unaware, I mean, he was aware of.
What were some of them?
Alec's weaknesses?
Yeah. Johnny asked me early on that, whether I thought Alec would make a good vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And I said I thought so.
Mm-hmm. I think that was right. I think Alec's weaknesses were he took things too seriously sometimes. I mean, he got so intense, he was driven. Of course, he, unlike Johnny, Stony Brook was in Alec's blood. It never got in Johnny's blood, it was in Alec's blood. You can be in a position too long. And I think the number two position is the prime one you can be in too long. Where you end up making decisions 10 years ago, because a lot of those decisions were made by him, that you then end up defending 10 years later, but the times have changed and whatever else. I think Alec was in that position. I think he also had lost his sense of perspective, which is his, only he in some sense knew, and I want to be fair here, but it's hard to be, how venomous the SUNY situation was. How, you know, and part of why I think Johnny and Alec never told the campus, hey, we have no support up there, we have no friends up there, was what that would have done to the campus morale. I mean, you're trying to tell people we have this great ambition and goal and let's go and so on and so forth. Only Alec. But you can't do that if you're also saying that nobody supports us. Alec said at the eulogy for Rob Siegel, he said that Stony Brook was founded something along the line, I forget the exact line, but a general went out and placed out a white flag, and you turned around and there was no one behind you. That's what Stony Brook was. Only Alec understood that in the detail of how, on a day-to-day basis, we had nobody up there who understood here. Nobody. And as a consequence of that, he just got angrier and angrier and angrier. His tolerance for the faculty was going further and further down, when in fact one of the reasons the faculty didn't know and were, well, I would say, naive and in some sense supercilious, because here were these absolutely critical issues for the future of the place and they were nibbling around the edges of silly issues. I mean, in a context, purely in a context. Well, one of the reasons was Alec and Johnny never told him, so of course they didn't know. Well, I mean, you're at the catch 22. But the end result was he was bitter. I think he was really quite angry. He knew what was at stake when Johnny left. Understood it. So Alec's weaknesses are he is not someone who has a warm, cuddly personality. As private as Johnny is, and he's a very private person, I don't know that he had a friend in that sense. I mean, a real friend.
You mean Alec didn't have a friend?
No, actually Alec did. Johnny didn't have a friend. I don't know a friend. I knew Johnny. I probably spent more time with Johnny over a 10-year period than anybody, just because of my office was right off his back door. My hours were such. Yeah. I was young. He didn't have a friend in the sense of somebody he would confide in and talk to about what was real. Alec did. I mean, there were some
nice jokes that you can talk about later.
Of
Johnny.
Oh yeah, and I mean I see Johnny every once in a while. Things and I will stop him and see him in Washington. But it's not. I mean, he was a lonesome character in his own way. He was a very private individual. Alec took these things so seriously because this Stony Brook issue was in his blood, that his sense of perspective, he had trouble stepping back sometimes. He would just get so angry at what was going on. And when the issue was up as to who was going to replace Johnny, there were a lot of reasons for it not to be out. A lot of very good reasons. One is, he's not a public person. The job requires a public presence. He was an ideal number two in some ways, but not necessarily number one. I think he had the intellectual capability. I think he had the sense of vision that wasn't there. But he'd made too many enemies over too long a period of time because he was the guy who conveyed the messages. Even if you looked at the structure, and your comment about why Sidney didn't go makes sense to me. Johnny was superb on picking on faculty issues. I mean, I watched him early on the tenure cases, and he read every page. And he would pick up the phone and call all over the country to who the best people were and say, tell me about this person. Would you hire this person? You know, that kind of thing. Sheldon spent 50% of his time or more doing tenure case reviews for Johnny. That's how rigorous Johnny was, because he believed that in the long run, there is no better way. The only way to do it is you build up quality, and in absence of tradition in the institution, that was fine. It was a great way to build it. And it succeeded. In large measure, it succeeded. The dilemma, though, it seemed to me, was it meant that through the process of tenure decisions, because everybody knew Tor would be so tough, no one else had to be.
Let me ask you one question. Dave Price, is that a name that...
I remember the name, but he...
had died?
I think he had died right before or right about the time I was there.
He was one of our supporters.
Yes. Yeah, well, that was a name I knew as a supporter, but he was not there. And I'm trying to think, I don't know, where is the measure with us? This is,
I've got to.
I think Johnny recognized Alex's weaknesses. He saw that he was angry and no longer, in some ways, in fact, could even be effective in working with the faculty leadership.
I was surprised to hear that about the local campus.
Well,
not a surprise to hear it in connection.
I think, let me put it this way. Johnny knew the weaknesses of having Alec do that, let me put it that way, at this stage. Because Alec had been the bad guy in so many different issues, no matter what the issues, whether they were budget cuts, whether they were budget priorities. Even if one goes back to the raging internal debate that was there the whole time I was there about the social sciences and humanities on campus. Part of what was not understood, it seemed to me, in that dynamic was the lack of SUNY support, which again Johnny couldn't talk about in some sense, so that they were always seen as the bad guys on that issue. They couldn't get it. When I used the social and behavioral sciences building, we had tried to get that building for 5 or 6 years. We knew how crucial it was. The strategy, for instance, for going for the Fine Arts Center, which should have been a much larger building.
Sure, right.
The strategy was, if you can build your excellence in the hard sciences over here, and build it in what I would call on a continuum of disciplines over here on the fine and performing arts, then you build in, and you gradually develop that excellence across the other. You start over in the middle, you've missed this group already. So there was a really conscious decision, I think, as part of an academic strategy. Someone you should talk to is Carl Carlucci. Do you remember him at all?
Carl Carlucci?
I'll tell you about Carl Carlucci. And remind me to go back to the performance.
Right.
Carl Carlucci was a very young... He's Frank Carlucci's cousin.
That's right.
He was a student at Stony Brook. He was hired as an intern in Woody Troutman's office. And Troutman was institutional planning.
Yeah,
okay. Nice, sweet man. I love that. But Carlucci is a brilliant young fellow. Carl's now in his late 30s. Carl was the number cruncher for Alec. He was the one who devised the number strategies for Alec. My involvement in a series of Albany-related activities started to get me with good relations with the higher ed committees and whatever else. And then they were looking for a person to join that staff and asked me who would be good. I told them Carl Carlucci would be. Carl Carlucci left Stony Brook. I left in 77 to go on sabbatical. Carl took over my responsibilities. He handled legislative stuff, political stuff for that year. I then came back. Carl left shortly thereafter to go work in the assembly for the legislature. Ultimately became the key staff person on the higher education committee. Ultimately became the person who redistricted the state for the Democrats in 1980. And is now the secretary of the Ways and Means Committee in the assembly. Carl Carlucci was the staff member on a commission in the around 80, maybe, yeah, right around that time. It took a whole new look at higher ed in the state. Johnny was on, it was right around the time Johnny was leaving, so maybe it wasn't then. But Carlucci has a wonderful perspective on the Stony Brook story, and understands the SUNY dynamic, the political dynamic, the whole routine. He is an enormously fond of Alex. Knows his weaknesses completely, but enormously fond. And Johnny too. And both of them have tried to hire him repeatedly. Carl, to this day, holds what happened at Stony Brook against the SUNY system, and they pay a price for that every single day today. As recently as last week, they paid a heavy price on that issue. But he really understood that issue in some ways in a far more detailed than I do.
Was he a Stony Brook student?
He was a Stony Brook student who then went to work for Stony Brook. But in his early 20s, literally ran the institution planning office. He is someone that literally, whatever he wants to do, he could do. He's a remarkable guy. The speaker, Mel Miller, the first appointment he made was Carlucci, secretary of Ways and Means. Chairman of Ways and Means didn't pick him the new speaker. He was president of Brooklyn College at the time. Anyway, back to this issue with Alec and Johnny and everything. The tenure issue where Johnny was so vigorous, rigorous, whatever. And the best example of that is the economist who was a Marxist.
Dubay?
No, not Dubay. Dubay is later. He's now there and he's no... I mean, he's like Abby Hoffman. He's moved. He's now middle of the road. Mike Zweig.
Oh, yeah, Michael Zweig, yeah.
In his heart, Johnny wanted to turn that tenure decision down. But he couldn't get away from what was in the file, and his head governed his heart. Politically, had he turned it down, it would have stood him in good stead with the Long Island political establishment. And Dwight was well known as this extreme radical, the Stony Brook Council. I mean, the whole routine, it would have been very... He looked at the stuff, and as much as he wanted to, he couldn't. And Johnny, I never once saw on... an academic issue, an academic tenure kind of decision, whatever else. The only issue was the quality issue. Just time and time and time again. The problem was that because he was so tough, others in the system didn't have to be. There was great tension. Not great tension, that's unfair. There was a degree of tension between a Diana and a Pellegrino and a Toll and a Pond that is qualitatively different from that was between a Bentley and a Johnny. Johnny went for the star system, you know, got Frank, got Bentley. I mean, these were wonderful appointments. But I don't, my sense of it again, and this is partly in retrospect, and I didn't have that much to do with Bentley, but I did see all the mails, was that Bentley never understood the political dynamic in Albany at all. At all. He was the great protector of the liberal arts, but couldn't protect it because he didn't understand the environment, the context.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of issue.
Yeah.
So that they naturally got into their tensions. Alec's temperament was such he'd get very frustrated with Bentley. Johnny never got frustrated. It was all part of the, you know, water off a duck's back. But again, Alec became the bad guy because he was the one. You know, who was the senior academic officer? It turned out Alec was the senior academic officer, not Bentley. Bentley didn't understand the issues. I don't know that Bentley understood that, but it was fairly clear. I mean, you could look at that. To some extent, why did we have a vice president for liberal studies? The reason we had a vice president for liberal studies was because we had a vice president for the health sciences, and Johnny was trying to establish that the vice president for the health sciences, right, is the equivalent of the vice president for liberal studies. In other words, and then there's an academic officer above him, and then there's an executive vice president above him. It had to do with the political context of this entity being placed in it. None of this was understood. Ed understood it. I mean, Ed Pulliquin understood it. I'm sure Sidney understood it. I'm not sure about Ed. But the situation was such that Sidney knew he could always pass the buck up. Bentley knew he could always pass the buck up. So the buck always got passed up toward Johnny. I mean, in some sense, on these decisions. Well, it was partly of Johnny's own making.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a catch-22. It keeps going around in a circle here. But the inner workings were such that the pivotal person, time and time again, was Alec in the middle of it. Because when you needed to make the arguments, Johnny turned to Alec. And Johnny knew where he wanted to go. Johnny knew the arguments. Go do it. Alec would come in with the arguments. Bentley had no capability to counter the arguments. Who's the bad guy? Well, Alec became the bad guy. In that search for the presidency, the issue was going to be the future of the institution. Now, I was then at Maryland. I had left Maryland before Johnny became president. I mean, I'd left Stony Brook to take a leave to work in a doctorate, and I had a year at half pay. And I was going to have a second year, which was leave without pay, to do it. Johnny, in the interim, comes down to Maryland as president. Everybody down there, all of a sudden I was a very hot graduate student, invited to all these parties. I couldn't quite understand it. It dawned on me that somebody figured out I knew told. They thought I was an advanced man in this thing. But Alec asked me if I would come back and take my second year leave later, because during this interim period it was going to be very important to have as many folks around who understood the ball game. So I said yes, and I moved back for that time period. We had a commuter marriage, most of it, but I was back at Stony Brook. I left for 77, 78, I went down to Maryland. I came back 78, 79.
You went down to Maryland as a graduate student?
As a graduate student.
I see.
Right. Anne had gotten a job. Anne got her master's under Laurie McHugh at the Marine Sciences Center. And she got a job at the Mid-Atlantic Regional Fishery Management Council, which is the... And that was in Dover, Delaware, so my doctorate was going to be dependent, the location of my work was going to be dependent on where she was, so I went there. So I came back for that year. I wrote a letter to Sam Easterbrook, who was a very key member of the council. I don't know if you remember him, but...
I remember his name, but I never had anything to do with him.
He was... First of all, he understood education in a way that most members of the council did. Most of them were much more political.
Sam and gravel people.
Right, exactly. Sam understood education. Frankly, I'm not sure I ever knew why. Sam was an economist who was the key person at New York Telephone in setting their rates. He understood demographics, he understood politics. I mean, he wasn't just an economist who understood the numbers, he understood the whole fabric of things. I think in his younger days, he was a Republican from Huntington, in his younger days, he confided in me once, he was the person who carried money from place to place or picked it up. Kind of a very interesting guy. I learned a ton from him. But he was the single member of the council who most understood the broader context of so many of these issues. And I'm going to digress for one second to say, but just as we had organized the council as a sort of a political issue for us, we certainly, the council then appointed the Stony Brook Council Advisory Committee, which brought in other people. Part of the problem you had was the council itself, in some ways, well-intentioned basically, but most of them were sort of political hacks in some ways. How were we going to begin to build a political base within it? So we set up this advisory council, and we had people from all over the island, from business and industry and labor. And, I mean, it was our way to establish some tentacles out there.
much like the foundation started to become the same thing. And, you know, I was doing that too when I tried to get the foundation dinner off the ground and begin to establish some friendships with them. Sam understood this whole picture better than anybody else on the calendar. And he was near the end of his term at that point. And I wrote him a long letter talking about the search. He had asked me about it. I was then down at Maryland. A long handwritten letter where I said that there would be enormous pressure to knock Alec out and knock him out early. There'd be pressure from the campus, there'd be certainly pressure from SUNY. And that I thought it very important that at least one member of the council understood the world that I had seen that Alec had played, which was not to say that I thought he should be the president, but somebody at least ought to understand this set of issues that were out there. I found that letter about a year and a half ago. It's somewhere up in the office.
You got a copy of that?
I can find it. Send it. There were a limited number of other people at the campus who I think understood the importance of the issue. Jerry Schubert was one. Because of his marine sciences program and his Sea Grant status with Cornell, he had spent more time in Albany and with political structure than others normally did at the campus. And he's extremely bright and understood. I mean, I liked your comment earlier about how's he doing. Well, within the context of the situation, as well as, that's the problem right there. Jerry understood the issue. Well, that search went on, and in some ways I was as responsible for the debacle as I was for anything else, in that I had argued that when Tobler was retired, that we should try to get Carey to appoint someone who really understood the higher education issues. And Andy Anderson had been appointed to the council. I think he'd already been appointed as a member. I'm pretty sure that's right. And he was a new kind of member. I mean, he was the first person who came. Johnny had tried to get him on. I don't know that he knew Andy that well. I don't think that was the issue. But it was somebody from Brookhaven at a high enough level who would understand these linkages. It was very important.
We'd had George Collins.
Right. That's right. But then after George left, there was nobody in the number. Well, I conceived of the idea of getting Andy to be chairman. A, he'd understand the issues. B, he'd give us credibility as a non-political kind of character. I was absolutely right. The problem was my own naivete, and to some extent I think his naivete. He is, if you haven't interviewed him, I would urge you to do so on these things. And he ultimately was appointed chairman. And the political process was not happy about this. We pushed this issue very hard through the governor's office to get it done. I think Andy was enormously bothered by what he saw as the constant political infighting at the university, whether it were these battles with SUNY where we just couldn't agree on anything. We were just knives and daggers all the time, as well as the internal tensions, which were as unhealthy for a campus as you. I mean, I really glossed over those, and I'm not doing that intentionally. It's just the areas in which I was really focused externally, but I'm very much aware of the fact that, the singular importance of a campus governance system that really works is when you need it, it's there. Well, we needed it several times, and it wasn't there. That kind of problem. But he was very troubled by it. He understood the academic issues that were at stake. He understood the frustrations of the humanities folks and the arts folks and so on and so forth. And he was bothered by Alec's style.
Style?
Just an angry, bitter, when the faculty would ask the legitimate question, but for the 10th time, Alec's view was squirrel, I don't have time to talk about this anymore. He just lost his patience with all of that. And that angered the faculty. And that was all known to Andy. Stony Brook was also an inhospitable place to students. We had lousy housing. I mean, all those things I talked about, the infrastructure before, the consumers of the product might get a damn good education from the faculty, but they couldn't get their grades, they couldn't get anything. I mean, you know, the bills were always screwed up, the financial aid programs were always screwed up, the housing was terrible. We didn't have a college town area with the normal kinds of amenities and services, you know, that the local environment provides at Cornell. I mean, you know, there are these, all the little shops off
the
campus.
The fine arts program now is much better.
Oh, yeah, but then, I mean, I'm going there, the fine arts had just come on board. Just come on. So, and he was very frustrated by that. He saw spending all of our time on what were political fights and facilities fights. And facilities, I mean, it's a funny game. Facilities define program. The program really should define facilities, but in the SUNY structure, the only way you could become a comprehensive place was to be able to get the building, because then they couldn't take the building away and had to fill it. I mean, it was the exact reverse of the way it ought to have been. But again, that was not widely understood either. That's the context of the system. That search started. Andy was the chair, and it was a disaster from start to finish. It was a disaster for any number of reasons, one of which was Cliff Wharton was new. Cliff Wharton was new,
yes.
Relatively new.
Right.
Cliff Wharton, I mean, walks into a situation where Stony Brook had been making life miserable for SUNY Central. I mean, even when I was on leave, I would periodically get a call from somebody at Stony Brook, Alec or Johnny, saying, could I place a call to one of my contacts in Albany and move something through? And I could do that easier from Maryland than anybody who was there, and I would do that. So I was very much aware of what was going on. But that, we were just so involved in that political fight, which was literally going to define the future of the university, that we weren't paying attention to all these other kinds of things that needed great attention. We just couldn't get to them. It was evident they weren't being paid attention to, but people, I think, made the wrong assumptions about why that was happening. In any event, Wharton comes on there, would like nothing better than to stop this rogue campus, which is what we had become. We had gone and used the political structure system in a way that was making their lives miserable and totally constraining the flexibility of central administration. Anytime there was a flexible dialogue, we had already gotten our oar in on it before SUNY had it. And in their system, you know the politics of that system somewhat, so you can understand. So it was clear that Wharton would not want Alec, and SUNY Central wouldn't want Alec. I mean, the bureaucrats up there wouldn't, under any circumstances. Wharton had a conversation with Anderson early on. This was not known until the very end, where he told him that there was no way he would approve Alec Pond coming forward as a candidate.
I didn't know anything.
That was the biggest piece of the puzzle, and that's where it all, in many ways, really fell apart. Nobody knew that. The search went on, and I think Andy was sure that in the course of the search, and Alec didn't have strong, I mean, Alec didn't have strong support on the board. I mean, he was on the council. I mean, his diffident personality, whatever else. He's not the type to go out and have a drink with these guys, you know, that kind of stuff. Not that Johnny was, but at least he's a character. You know, that kind of thing. And I think Andy thought, well, we won't need to worry about that, Cliff, because it'll never happen. I mean, it won't go through the process. Well, as the process went along,
Alec had support from the business community.
Well, Alec had very strong support from what I call the political community. If you go back and look at the letters of support that came from Alec, for Alec and the thing, they were very broad-gauged externally. Some powerful political people, the business community, which saw Stony Brook as a key element of the development, even Newsday. I mean, Newsday was trying to help. Which is not to say they were trying to go for him. I don't think that that was the case until the very end when it was falling apart. And people realized, oh, what's this ballgame that's being played? But when the council brought in the various candidates, Ann and I, in that interim year, lived in the president's house. We caretook it. So we met each of the candidates, plus I was secretary of the council and was involved in all those meetings as those meetings were going on, as they were making their judgments. It was not a very sophisticated search. I mean, the council was doing it, you know.
They didn't know how to do it, right?
Well, at some level they didn't. I mean, they don't know the right questions to ask, anyway.
Or the places to go look.
The places to go. Although they had wonderful candidates come through. I mean, the five finalists. One was Mike Heyman, who's now Chancellor at Berkeley, who was a finalist at every place in the country, and it was he was waiting for Berkeley and went around and was offered every. He withdrew before the council voted. I'll get back to that issue.
Right.
Well, there was the vice chancellor, number two guy at Irvine, who in fact was very impressive. I think the council was very impressed by him. He was the one I was least impressed by. He was a psychologist of considerable distinction, but he had been his undergraduate major had been theater, and I was struck by what a great, how on stage he was and how effective he was. But on the substantive issues, he didn't seem to be there, and what I at least found out from my folks I could check with in California was not that positive. Mort Weir, who is now Chancellor at Urbana, would have been a good choice in Rothman. But Mort was a very quiet guy, much more quiet in his search when he came to the campus than he really is. I mean, he came off quite different than I think he really is, and whatever. I forget who the fourth was, a guy that Cliff had put in, who was a black, who was the chancellor at UMass Amherst, who was a real lightweight. He was a geologist. Worked for the Geological Survey. Schubel and others knew him as an academic joke. So it really came down to
Alec. What
did he know? Yes, well, he was...
Something about Wharton.
Well, I'll say something about Wharton in a second, but if you look at almost every one of Cliff's major appointments at the campuses, they were deans. There was nobody who came from a presidency to a presidency. I say that because, I mean, I did my doctorate work on organizational behavior and theory. Deans are folks in the middle. They're not the ones who make the decisions frequently. They're caught between the pressures from above and below, and they are conciliators. They have to be. Well, that's what Cliff wanted in his presidency, because he wanted to be able to run the show. He wanted people down there as conciliators. So, I mean, this is purely my own theory. I don't have any basis, but that is what it was. So here are your five candidates. Heyman, who didn't want it. Weir, who probably would have been good, but...